Good afternoon and welcome to the May meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Hedges Hall in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for our president, George Look, who is away. This is forum meeting number 410. Founded in 1983, the forum is now into its 35th year of bringing you on a monthly basis speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. By the way, over these 35 years, we have never missed a monthly meeting. Details about past and upcoming programs are available at our website at midcoastforum.org. The forum is delighted today to bring you Chris Miller, author of Putinomics, Power and Money in a Resurgent Russia, a brand new book just out last month, and the topic of today's talk. Chris is at the Fletcher School, a professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts, and he focuses on the region of what once was the Soviet Union. And he focuses on it in a fairly hands-on way. For instance, last week he was in the Ukraine, and next week he's going to be in Kazakhstan. He's going to, later in a couple of months after that, on the same trip via Finland and Moscow, he's going to end up in Siberia and the Kamchatka Peninsula. So this is very much of a hands-on researcher. He's the author of a couple of books. The earlier one was The Struggle to Save the Soviet Economy, Mikhail Gorbachev and the Collapse of the USSR, published 2 years ago. And he's here today to tell us about Putinomics. Chris Miller, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you to the organizers for the invitation to speak here today. It's, of course, a very interesting time to talk about Russia, not only because, as Americans, we think about the role that Russia's playing in our own debates, but also in the Russian political cycle. It's also an interesting time because Vladimir Putin was not only just reelected to a fourth term as president of Russia, but earlier this month, he was inaugurated into this new term, and he's just now announcing what his new cabinet will be. So we might see a couple of changes in terms of how Russia is governed at home and maybe even how it enacts foreign policy abroad. So it's actually a good time to think back about what has gone right and wrong for President Putin as he enters what will soon be his third decade in power. And one of the questions I'd like to pose to you today is, how has he done it? How is it that President Putin is approaching his third decade in power? This is a country that's not that easy to govern. Russia is a challenging place to govern. It has any number of problems, and it's in a very difficult neighborhood and in a confrontation with its most important neighbors. And yet, nonetheless, Putin has managed to retain power despite a series of shocks. And so this is the puzzle I'd like to put at the front of our conversation today. How is it that Putin has managed to retain power for so long, facing almost no domestic opposition of any sort of significance, and retaining this confrontation with his neighbors? That's the puzzle at the center of my remarks today. And I'm going to title my talk Putinomics, which is the title of my new book, but it's also, I think, an important set of principles that has governed how Russia and how Vladimir Putin has managed Russia's economy over the past two decades. And what I'd like to do today is lay out these principles, the principles behind Putinomics, and then to suggest to you that because of these principles, Putin has been able to retain power at home and deploy it abroad despite the variety of shocks that he's faced in recent years. So let me first set out the dilemma, set out the puzzle in very detailed terms. Since 2014, just 4 years ago, Russia has faced a series of very significant economic shocks. So first off, in 2014, the price of oil fell very drastically from over $100 a barrel at the beginning of 2014 down to half that level by the end of the year, sinking even lower in 2015. And of course, oil and gas are Russia's two largest export products. So when the price of oil and gas falls, Russia's economy takes a very serious hit. And at the same time that Oil prices were falling in 2014. Russia was beginning its intervention in Ukraine, first annexing the Crimean Peninsula in March 2014, and then following that up several months later by support for a variety of militia groups, and then eventually deploying the Russian army in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbas region. And this, of course, was not merely a political confrontation of the first order, the largest political confrontation between Russia and the West since the end of the Cold War, but it also sparked an economic confrontation because in response to the annexation of Crimea and Russia's support for the militias in the Donbas, the West levied a series of very tough economic sanctions on Russia. And in response, Russia responded with its own economic sanctions against the West. So first off, the Western sanctions restricted the ability of many of Russia's largest firms, its largest banks, its largest energy companies from raising equity or issuing debt in Western capital markets, which they had relied upon for a long time. And at the same time, the West also banned the export of high-tech drilling equipment to Russia, which limited Russia's ability to drill, for example, in a variety of offshore oil fields. And then in response to that, Russia responded with its own economic sanctions against the West. But one of the ironies of Russia's sanctions is that they actually hit Russians harder than they hit Westerners. So Russia prohibited the importation of a variety of food products, especially from European farmers, trying to punish European farmers for Western sanctions. But as it turns out, we now know 4 years later, European farmers were able to very quickly find new markets for their food products, whereas Russians had to suffer higher food prices as they imported from more expensive providers. So just as Western sanctions hit Russians pretty hard, so too Russian counter-sanctions ended up hitting Russians pretty hard as well. And a third type of sanction was the collapse in Russian-Ukrainian trade at the time when the Russian-Ukrainian war was picking up steam. Because for a long time, Ukraine was one of Russia's largest trading partners, but both because of administrative restrictions on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side, that trade has now dwindled close to zero. So for a whole variety of different reasons, all stemming from the crisis in Ukraine, Russia has suffered a very significant blow because of these types of sanctions. So first you had the oil price crash, then you had sanctions, and sitting behind that you have a business climate that has been at best mediocre for most of the past 25 years. And you can have any number of examples of why the business climate is so bad. My favorite recent example is one oligarch named Vladimir Yevtushenko, who was suffered from an assault by a very influential Russian oligarch who wanted to steal one of his businesses. And so this other oligarch began a judicial process totally fabricated against Yevtushenko and managed to steal a business worth $5.5 billion from Yevtushenko. And this is just one of many different examples of Russian oligarchs stealing assets from other oligarchs. And the effect of this, of course, is to depress business investment, because if you're a Russian who has money and you're deciding, should I invest in Russia or should I invest in Europe or in the United States? Well, it's much safer to invest in a different country where property rights are more secure. So unless you're very sure about your ability to maneuver within the Russian political system and the judicial system, and unless you're very sure that your investment will have a high return, it's safer to invest elsewhere. So fewer people invest in Russia than they otherwise would. So you have the collapse in oil prices in 2014, the imposition of sanctions both by Russia and by the West, and all of this occurring in the context of a business environment that has discouraged investment not only over the past several years, but since the emergence of independent Russia in 1991. So a series of very tough economic shocks. As a result of these, since 2014, the ruble has crashed. It was around 35 to the dollar in 2014, sinking to a low of around 70 and then even 80 to the dollar in 2016 before recovering briefly, but only to a certain extent. It's still around 55 or 60 to the dollar today. And so Russians are far poorer in dollar terms today than they were 4 years ago. And again, this is the direct effect of oil price crashes plus sanctions. At the same time, Russia's economy has sunken into recession. GDP growth was positive in the early part of 2014, but as oil prices crashed and as the effects of the annexation of Crimea and the sanctions that followed became clearer, Russia sank into a very deep recession. Its economy shrank by over 3% in 2015, and only recently has it returned to growth. And of course, the growth that Russia has seen since late 2016 and throughout 2017 is actually not very impressive growth for a country of Russia's income level. Russia is a relatively poor country compared, for example, to its neighbors in Europe, and yet nonetheless, Russia is growing slower than most of its neighbors. If you compare Russia to Poland or to Romania or to many other countries in Central Europe, Russia is significantly underperforming. And so the economic gap between Europe and Russia and also between the US and Russia is growing significantly every year because both most European countries and the United States are growing more rapidly than Russia is today. So Russia's got a return to very slow GDP growth, but not the type of growth that you'd expect to see, and certainly not the type of economic growth that we saw in Russia in the 2000s when the economy was growing at 5 or 6 or even 7% a year. And as the economy slowed and as the ruble crashed, so too did people's wages. So if you adjust wages for inflation, which was very high in Russia in 2015, Russians experienced a devastating decline in real wages in 2015 and 2016. Wages fell by around 10% in 2015. And to put that into context, that's far, far more significant than the effect of the 2008-2009 financial crisis in the U.S. on real wages, where by most metrics, real wages hardly declined at all. If we had a 10% decline in real wages in the U.S., we would all be out on the streets with pitchforks demanding our congresspeople's heads. But in Russia, there's been nothing of the sort. There's been almost no protest, despite a deep recession, despite the collapse of the currency, despite a devastating decline in real wages. President Putin, by most metrics that we have, remains about as popular as he's ever been. So for example, if you look at popularity ratings, look at the percentage of Russians who approve versus those who disapprove of President Putin's work in office, what you'll find is that around 70 or 80% of Russians say they think Putin is doing a good job. And so you might ask, well, maybe Russians aren't responding honestly to the surveys. When a pollster calls them up, maybe Russians don't feel safe saying, well, I don't trust the pollster. Maybe there'll be negative repercussions if I say that I don't think President Putin's doing a good job. But in fact, political scientists have looked into this in great detail, and what they found is that maybe the official data slightly overestimates the number of Russians who approve of President Putin, but no matter how much you discount the data, it's hard to find any sort of evidence that less than 70% of Russians support President Putin. So by all accounts, the majority of Russians think that Putin is doing at least a decent job, certainly better than all of the other candidates that would be possible successors to him. So there's a puzzle. If in the United States we entered a deep recession, if in the United States everyone's wages fell on average by 10%, if in the United States we had our currency fall in value by half, there would be a very sharp political response, and I would suspect it would be almost immediate. But in Russia, we're now 4 years past when the price of oil began plummeting, along with it the ruble. We're now over 3 years since the Russian economy entered recession and since real wages began falling very rapidly, and yet there's been no political response whatsoever. President Putin won re-election. Of course, it was an election that was far from free and fair, but nonetheless, he won it very easily with around 70% of the vote earlier this year in March. And at the same time, there have been very few protests of any scale against his rule. So for example, when Putin last won re-election in 2012 for his previous term, his re-election was greeted by mass protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg and other large cities against him returning to power. People were sick of him, people wanted him to leave, but this time it appears to be different. There were almost no big protests when Putin retook power. There were a couple of small protests in Moscow, but nothing of a scale that would make the Kremlin worried. So there's been no negative political response against Putin's policies from the population, despite the economic record over the past 4 years. So that, I think, represents a fundamental dilemma for us as we try to understand Russia. So what I'd like to do now is put up for you a couple of images of how Americans normally think about Russia and then suggest that those images only explain part of what's going on in Russia. So for example, when when I talk to audiences and ask them, well, what do you think of when I mention the word Russia or the Russian government? And people often say, well, the Russian government is extraordinarily violent. It's waging war in Ukraine and Syria. It's assassinating people in Britain using chemical weapons. So that's one image, Russia as being a violent government run by the security services. And that's absolutely true. It's absolutely true that former KGB agents play an enormous role in Russian politics. Not only President Putin, but the heads of many state-owned companies are also former KGB agents. Americans also think of Russian corruption. So, for example, many of Putin's longtime friends who had no evident business acumen when Putin became president are now billionaires. Probably not a coincidence that they're now billionaires. And indeed, by every metric we have, Russia is very corrupt, more corrupt than you would expect given its income levels. And normally there's a correlation. As you get wealthier, countries get less corrupt. But that hasn't been visible in Russia. And we also have images of Putin as a macho man, Putin as someone trekking through Siberia with his shirt off. Can someone like this really be good at managing a country, we might ask? But the answer has actually been, well, by certain metrics, yes, at least by the metrics he himself uses, which is that he wants to stay in power as long as possible, as most dictators do. And he also wants to achieve certain goals internationally. He wants to make Russia a great power again, and he believes that he can do that by retaining Russia's dominant role in the post-Soviet space in countries such as Ukraine and in Georgia. And by these metrics, Russia's doing reasonably well. Now, of course, I didn't say that one of his goals was maximizing GDP growth. I didn't say that one of his goals was to make sure that living standards are increasing every year. Those haven't been achieved, but they weren't key goals in the first place. And if you understand that Putin's goals might be different than your goals would be if you were the president of Russia, then I think a lot of the policies that have been implemented over the past 20 years begin to make a lot more sense. So let me dive into the pillars of Putinomics, the key themes that have driven Russian economic policymaking over the past 20 years, and the key policies that have ensured that Putin has been able to retain power and retain popularity, even as by most of the metrics that you and I might find important, living standards and wages have been performing relatively badly. So first, Russia has focused on sound macroeconomic management, keeping inflation relatively low, keeping budget deficits very low, making sure the government doesn't rack up a big debt burden. And as a result of this, and this has been a principle that Putin and his fellow rulers of Russia have stuck to since they took power in 1999, as a result of this, Russia, every single year when the International Monetary Fund goes to Russia and assesses Russian economic policy, the IMF gives Russia very high marks every year because, judged by their macroeconomic management, Russia is doing an extraordinarily successful job. International capital markets lend to Russia at very low rates, despite the war in Ukraine, despite the war in Syria, precisely because the country hasn't taken on much debt and has a very low budget deficit. The second pillar of Putinomics is to very carefully use social policy. And in the Russian context, what that means is making sure that pensions are paid out on time and in relatively high levels because older people in Russia vote and they protest when their pensions are not paid out or when their pensions are cut. But for other types of social spending, especially social spending that's targeted towards younger groups, education spending, for example, that's been de-emphasized. And indeed, you've seen by many metrics stagnation, if not decline, in Russian spending on education. Because unlike the elderly in Russia, the youth generally don't protest and don't vote. And with a couple of exceptions, there have been very limited political action by the youth against the Russian government's behavior. So the Russian government is responding to incentives. The pensioners get angry, they get higher pensions. The youth don't complain, they get lower education spending. And this policy, I would argue, has been very successful in political terms. It's managed discontent very astutely, even though in the long run, of course, it's not a wise policy at all to overinvest in pensions and underinvest in education. And the third pillar of Putinomics, which is also absolutely crucial to understanding why it's worked so well from Putin's perspective, is to understand the difference between Russia today and the Soviet Union of 30 years ago. The Soviet Union, where Vladimir Putin came of age, where he served in the KGB, and the Soviet Union, which eventually collapsed, causing not only trauma for his country, but for Vladimir Putin personally. And this is that unlike in the Soviet Union, where the central government tried to control almost every single economic activity from the center. There was a bureaucracy in Moscow that set the prices of tomatoes as far away as Uzbekistan. Every price was set centrally. Almost every quantity that was produced was set centrally. Today, it's not like that in Russia. The state dominates certain key strategic sectors, like the financial sector, like the energy sector, but otherwise, private businesses are more or less left alone, which isn't to say that they're treated well. Certainly, there's lots of red tape they face. Certainly, they face a high tax burden. But it's also not the case that they're run as inefficiently as they were in the Soviet period. And as a result, the parts of the economy that Putin ignores have managed to do reasonably well. So if you look at the steel industry, for example, or the supermarket industry, these are sectors of the economy that have performed reasonably effectively. They've managed to increase their productivity in recent years, adopt Western technology. And so when people say, and you often hear this in the media, that Putin is trying to recreate the Soviet Union, I would say, well, only in certain ways, but not in other ways. And this is a key difference between the Soviet period and Russia today. So these are the key three pillars of Putinomics. First, sound macroeconomic management and low deficit, low debt levels. Second, targeted use of social policy to keep politically influential groups happy. And third, letting the private sector work in places that aren't politically important. So outside of the financial sector and outside of the energy sector above all. So what I'd like to do now is to sketch out these principles in action to show you how they've functioned over the past couple of years. So first off, the macroeconomic management strategy. So as everyone knows, Russia is extraordinarily dependent on oil and gas exports. That's just a fact of life because Russia happens to sit on some of the richest oil and gas reserves in the world. And so Russia's government has long known that their economy and their government budget is extraordinarily vulnerable to increases and decreases in oil prices. So it's good when oil prices increase, it's bad when they decrease. And so today, oil and gas taxation make up something around half of the Russian government budget. And so as a result, there's great pressure when there are times of high oil prices, the government is flush with revenue, and there's great pressure to spend money inefficiently, to spend money on pet causes of various Duma members, to spend money on various oligarchs' businesses. And it's easy to think of many countries that are reliant on oil that do spend all their money when oil prices are high. So for example, you might think of Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez came to power in the 2000s. Oil prices were high. He thought he had lots of money. He spent very recklessly. And as a result, when oil prices fell, Chavez's Venezuela almost fell apart. And it's on the brink of defaulting. It's in the midst of hyperinflation. Well, that hasn't happened in Russia. And it's important to understand what the differences are. So first, unlike in countries like Venezuela, Russia saved an extraordinary amount of money in the 2000s when oil prices were high. So for example, if you look at Russia's foreign exchange reserves, the dollars, euros, and British pounds that Russia has accumulated, they increased extraordinarily rapidly in the 2000s when all the oil money was coming in, going up from almost zero in 2000 to over $500 billion by 2007. So this was a very sensible fiscal policy designed to make sure that when oil prices declined, Russia had money with which to cushion the blow. And indeed, it's inevitable for a country like Russia that when oil prices decline, so too GDP will decline as well. It's a fact of life for a country that produces so much oil that they will be dependent on the ups and downs in the oil market. And we saw that in 2008, 2009 when oil prices declined. We saw it again in 2014 and 2015 when oil prices declined. But Russia has managed to learn lessons from previous periods of oil price decline that it applied to its response to the current crisis. And the key comparison here is between what Russia did in 2008, 2009, the last big period of oil price declines, versus the most recent crisis. So in 2008 and 2009, as oil prices crashed, Russia tried to keep its currency pegged to the dollar, tried to keep the ruble-dollar exchange rate more or less constant. And to do that, it needed to spend down its foreign exchange reserves, buying rubles and selling dollars on the open market. And for a while, it seemed like that policy might work in keeping the ruble pegged, but at the end, the Russians feared that they were running out of dollars, that they might face a point where they didn't have enough dollars and would have to let the ruble fall catastrophically. And in the end, they had to eventually let the ruble decline, but only after having spent down nearly half of their foreign exchange reserves. And so when the Russian government did a post-mortem on the 2008-2009 crisis, they said, we chose the wrong policy. It was dangerous to spend down our foreign exchange reserves so drastically. What if something bad had happened on top of this? What if there had been an international conflict? And of course, in 2008, there was a war with Georgia, which almost embroiled Russia in a big confrontation with the West. And so the Russian government concluded that a policy of trying to keep its currency pegged to the dollar when oil prices were falling risked Russia having to spend down all of its foreign exchange reserves. And that's a risk that Russia decided it was unwilling to take. True, there were benefits of keeping your currency stable. There were benefits in that inflation didn't increase. There were benefits in that Russian firms that had borrowed abroad in dollars didn't face higher repayment costs. But there were also costs to such a policy. And the biggest cost was that you had to spend down your foreign exchange reserves, which you had accumulated so carefully over the previous decade, to do so. And so when the Kremlin entered the 2014 crisis and saw the price of oil tumbling again, they concluded that they needed to learn from the 2008-2009 experience and try a different policy. And so if you think back to 2014 and you look at newspaper headlines at the time, it was possible to find any number of newspapers declaring that Russia had lost control of the ruble, that the ruble was catastrophically falling. But in fact, this was a deliberate policy by the Russian Central Bank to let the ruble decline very rapidly in order both to conserve Russia's foreign exchange reserves, to make sure Russia had the room for maneuver that large reserves of dollars and euros provided, but also to defend the Russian government budget, which was also a key goal of their macroeconomic policies. And to understand how this worked, it's crucial to think of how the Russian government makes and spends its money. So as I mentioned before, Russia makes about half of its government budget revenue from taxing oil and gas. So it taxes barrels of oil sold abroad, and it gets dollars in exchange. But Russia spends almost all of its money in rubles. Russian government pays pensions in rubles, state salaries in rubles, the military is funded in rubles, so all of its expenditures are in rubles. So the key question for Russia's government is not how many dollars does it have coming in, but how many rubles does it have coming in? And so when you think about the effect of devaluation, that increases the number of rubles you get for each barrel of oil you sell. So when you look at the dollar price of oil in 2014 and 2015, it collapsed. And this was the effect of international oil markets. But when you look at the ruble price of oil, because the ruble was falling along with the price of oil, the ruble price of oil stayed roughly constant. The Russian government had as many rubles coming in the door as a result as it had going out the door. So thanks to devaluing the ruble, Russia's government was able to keep its government budget almost completely balanced. So to put this in perspective, Russia's government in 2014 had a deficit of around 3% of GDP, slightly higher than 3%. This year, the United States is expected to have a deficit of around 5 or 6% of GDP. So in the midst of one of the sharpest economic crises that Russia had seen since independence, its government was running a budget that was pretty close to being balanced. And this was precisely because they chose to let the ruble collapse and therefore let the ruble price of oil stay roughly constant. Now, this was a great policy for the government because the government was pleased it had room for maneuver in fiscal terms in case it wanted to spend more money on certain priorities. For example, the war in Ukraine, which was picking up pace in 2014. But it was a costly policy for the population, not only because it helped to drive the economy into recession, but also because it imposed very significant costs on the population due to inflation, because as the ruble collapsed, the price of imported goods increased, and so this is why you had the very sharp decline in real wages that I discussed earlier. So it was a direct consequence of the Russian government's decision to defend their government budget balance. As a result of that decision, Russia pushed the cost of adjustment on the population, and Russian wages fell by roughly 10%. That was a very clear trade-off. The Russian government knew it had that trade-off, and it said, we'd rather defend the government budget, rather make sure we don't have a big government deficit, and instead we'll make the population pay the bill via a cheaper ruble, which will buy fewer goods abroad, increase prices, and therefore drive down inflation-adjusted living standards. So they had a choice. Should the government foot the bill or should the population? And they push the costs onto the population. Now, this is a strategy that works very well provided you have a certain type of political system. In the United States, this strategy would not work well because the population would be very unhappy with you. And indeed, across the world, when we look at countries that face the choice of whether to devalue their currency, most governments say, well, I understand the logic of devaluation, but my population will immediately oust me from office if I do so. But the Russian government concluded, accurately it turns out, that there wouldn't be any negative political costs for devaluing. The Russian population wouldn't complain if they had to pay the cost of the decline in oil prices rather than the government. And so if you look at Russia's government balance sheet, it looks almost unchanged today compared to 4 years ago. Whereas if you look at Russian households, they're significantly poorer than they would have been had the Russian government chosen a different route. So the structure of the Russian political system, the fact that Russians are willing to tolerate these types of costs, and the fact that the Russian government has proven very adept at using pressure to silence those who do complain, means that Putin had a free hand to shift the costs of the adjustment on the population. So this is the first key pillar of Putinomics, to stabilize the macroeconomic system and to push the cost of adjustment onto the population. The second pillar, as I suggested, is very targeted use of social policy. And as I mentioned before, what this means is spending a lot of money on pensions and spending a lot less than you otherwise would on things like health or education or infrastructure. So if you look at pensions in Russia, and just to put pensions in context, every Russian, women over the age of 55, men over the age of 60, get a state pension. And for almost all Russians, their state pension makes up almost all of their retirement income. So it's more significant than Social Security in the United States, just because for most Russians, this is all they have to live on. So it's one of the most important political issues in Russia. And in the 1990s, before Putin came to power, pensions were regularly paid late, behind schedule, and they were regularly declining in inflation-adjusted terms. But when Putin came to power, in part because of all the new oil revenue he had coming into the doors, but also in part because he realized that by focusing on payouts to pensioners, he could bolster his popularity, pension payments shot up. They were paid on time, and the actual size of pension payouts increased almost every single year that Putin was in power. So in the 2000s, they increased at 10 or even 20% a year. And even when you got to the more recent years, when the economic situation was much less positive, nonetheless, with only one exception, pensions have been growing rather than declining every single year, even at times of deep economic crisis. And so this has been a very effective political strategy. As I mentioned before, older people vote, and by and large, they vote for Putin. The cost of this, though, is that if you want to have a balanced government budget, more or less, and you're not willing to raise taxes, if you want to spend more on pensions, you have to cut spending somewhere else. And the place that Russia has decided to cut spending is on other types of social spending as well as on infrastructure. So Russian infrastructure has been underinvested in for the past two decades, and health and education spending have been particularly ignored. And so if you look at Russian health spending or education spending relative to its peers, it spends far less as a share of GDP than many comparable countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And as a result, the Russian population is less healthy and less well-educated than it otherwise would be. And of course, as a long-term strategy, this is not a wise policy decision. You'd rather be investing in your future rather than spending on current consumption. But as a political strategy, it's worked brilliantly, because the people that really matter, the older people, are relatively pleased. And the people who haven't made their voice heard, and thus far there's no evidence that the youth will make their voice heard, have suffered the consequences. But from Putin's perspective, this political calculus makes perfect sense. So these are the themes that have let Putin survive the past 4 years of economic crisis and the last 20 years since he first took power at the end of 1999. But what I hope I've suggested for you is that although Putin has done fairly well over the past two decades, ruling a challenging country to rule, managing it in a context of confrontation with the United States and all of the major European powers, and doing so well, the price of oil is significantly depressed compared to where it was earlier in his term, he faces a series of tough choices as he assembles his new cabinet and prepares for the next 6 years. And there are two main strategies, two main schools of thought for what Russia can do as it looks forward. And the big question is, can Russia continue with policies that guarantee stagnation? Is it durable to have policies that will have Russia growing at maybe 1% or maximum 2% a year for the foreseeable future? Or does Russia need to shake things up and try to find methods to make things more efficient and to increase growth. And so the first school of thought says that, yes, Russia must go for growth. Stagnation is not stable. And this is a school of thought that's affiliated with men such as Alexei Kudrin, the former finance minister who served under Putin almost a decade in Putin's first decade in power. And people like Kudrin have put forth a number of different ideas to make Russia's economy more efficient, to make its government less wasteful. But the challenge that they face is that although all their ideas on paper look pretty good, when they're put in political context, they look totally unrealistic. So for example, Kudrin has proposed that Russia should cut waste at state-owned energy firms such as Gazprom and Rosneft, which are the Russian state-owned gas and oil companies. And this, of course, is a great idea because these firms, by all accounts, waste literally billions of dollars a year. So, for example, some of these firms have to buy their pipeline equipment from only a small number of pipeline-producing firms in Russia, most of which are owned by friends of President Putin. So you can imagine the types of contracts get written in such a context. So there's no doubt that there's plenty of inefficiency that could be cut out of Russian state-owned firms. But doing so requires tackling some of the people who are most powerful in the Russian political system. So for example, the CEO of Rosneft, the largest Russian oil firm, Igor Sechin, is widely believed to be the second most powerful person in Russia, behind only Vladimir Putin. So if you want to cut waste at Russian state-owned firms, you got to tackle the guys who run them. And all of them are friends of Putin. At the same time, if you want to improve the business climate and make it harder for local prosecutors to steal businesses from their rivals, you've got to shut down a business that's been very profitable for local prosecutors. And they happen to be pretty influential figures in local and provincial government in Russia. And if you want to pay for investments in health and education, we have to find something else to cut. And so Kudrin, for example, has proposed cutting military spending, but that's not very popular. But then what else do you cut? Do you cut pensions? Well, Kudrin has also suggested maybe increasing the retirement age in Russia. But of course, making sure that pensioners are doing relatively well has been a central part of the economic strategy that has underlay Putin's time in office. So although there are lots of ideas about how to make Russia's economy less stagnant, to increase efficiency and growth, none of them are politically very easy. All of them would increase the political risk for Putin rather than reducing it, which is why a second school of thought, embrace stagnation and hope that the oil price goes up a bit, is in some ways the more politically appealing one for the Russian president. So when you think of people I mentioned before, like Igor Sechin, the head of Rosneft, the large state-owned oil company, people like Sechin think things are going all right. Russia's a great power again on the world stage. Other great powers are listening to it. Russia's made its interests known in Ukraine and Syria. Putin was reelected to a fourth term. He's got six more years without any sort of political challenges ahead. And the Russian population remains completely docile. There aren't significant protests. There's no reason to think there will be significant protests later this year. And so when people like Sechin go to Putin and they say, well, some of your advisors are advocating risky changes. True, they might increase growth, but what does growth matter when you've got stability? Growth means risk, but stability means keeping you and your friends in power. And so it wasn't a surprise to me or to many Russians when last week Putin appointed the prime minister for his next term in office, and it's the prime minister who was in power during his last term in office too. And indeed, many of the faces who are running the new ministries in Putin's fourth term are people who have run ministries in Putin's third term and even his first and second terms too. So it seems to me that when you look at the calculus that is in front of President Putin, do you risk changes that might increase economic growth but also might undermine the political support that has sustained you in power? Or do you keep things as they are, recognizing that it will guarantee stagnation, growth of maybe 1 or 2% a year, but also that it will be the politically least risky option? Putin, it seems to me, is opting for the latter one. And when you put yourself in Putin's shoes, you can see why he would think that. Because from his perspective, his foreign policy is working all right. He's gotten part of what he wanted in Ukraine, part of what he wanted in Syria. He's recognized as a great power on the world stage. And he's recognized in Russia as the dominant political figure for at least six more years. And if he wants to change the constitution after that and become president for another term, he probably can do that as well. So from Putin's perspective, stagnation, which Westerners use as a word to criticize Russia, but stagnation when you're the president doesn't sound all that bad. And so when you look forward and think, what will Russia look like in 6 years' time, from Putin's perspective is, well, he doesn't want that much change because the way Russia looks today is the way he's created it. And so any sort of change requires great risk. And when you run Russia for 20 years and manage to survive such a series of crises, the conclusion that you naturally draw is that your policies have worked. So why change them? So with that, I'd like to welcome any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Wow. That was something. Both Russia and China came out of a collective state in the around the same time, abandoned collectivism. China seems to have done much better. Why is that? It's a big question, I know.
This is a very big question, and it was actually, I'm glad you've asked it because it was the topic of my first book. Something I've thought a lot about. You know, there was a pretty common thesis that what went wrong in Russia is that they didn't know the right strategy. If only they'd thought harder or found better ideas, that it would have been possible to follow the Chinese path. But actually, when you look at economic policymaking in the final years of the Soviet Union, and I've done this by spending time looking through Mikhail Gorbachev's personal archive, which is now available in Moscow, what you find is that actually Soviet policymakers were extraordinarily focused on China. They tried to learn from China. They sent their advisors to Shanghai and Beijing to study the Chinese model. And so it wasn't that they didn't know what was going on in China. It wasn't that they didn't understand what needed to be done. It was that the legacy of the Soviet system presented such a break on reform. It was impossible to make the reforms that they needed. So let me give you an example. The military-industrial complex in the Soviet Union consumed around 15% or so of GDP. So the U.S. spends 3 or 4% of GDP on the military. The Soviet Union's was 15% of GDP. Gorbachev, when he came to power, from the outset wanted to decrease military spending in the Soviet Union. And yet they were so powerful that all the way, he came to power in 85, all the way through 1990 and maybe even 1991, there was no decrease at all in military spending because Gorbachev wasn't powerful enough to push it through the system. So the military proved impossible to reform. And at the same time, if you look at other parts of the Soviet economy, like the collective farm system, for example, so rather than individual farms, the Soviets had large collective farms that had hundreds of farmers on them. And here, too, the collective farm institutions were extraordinarily resistant to change. So, for example, during the final years of the Soviet Union, the Soviets had roughly 4 times as many tractors as the United States did, given the amount of agricultural output they had. So they had far too many tractors. But, of course, the tractor enterprises, the factories that were producing tractors, found this state of affairs pretty appealing because they had to sell a lot of tractors, and they did pretty well off of that. And so when Gorbachev would go to the tractor firms and say, we need to decrease our tractor production, we're overproducing in tractors, there was an immense political backlash because the tractor firms not only employed lots of people, but they had allies and patronage networks across the Soviet bureaucracy. And so unlike in China, where Deng Xiaoping had a relatively free hand to implement economic reforms in the 1980s, when Gorbachev came to power, he faced immensely resistant bureaucracies in the military, in the agriculture sector, in the fuel and energy sector. And as a result, they obstructed every reform he tried to make, and he couldn't make the changes that were necessary.
Well, we have a host of questions that use the word czar. But let me put a couple of these together. You said that Russia is a challenging country to govern, but the Russian psyche seems to like czars. Another person said that there's a great stoicism that we attribute to the Russian population. Why does the Russian population not expect better from the Putin government?
Well, I'm resistant to the thesis that Russians are innately people that prefer to be governed by a czar, in part because we don't have a good test of this hypothesis. If we had a period where Russia was a democracy and had a period where Russia was governed by czars, either in their previous form or in their current day form, we could know which do Russians like better. But the reality is we've only really had a test of the latter. There hasn't been a long period in which Russians were given the opportunity to have democratic governance and assess what they actually think. And indeed, when you look at people who are Russian-speaking, culturally Russian, who live in other countries, it's not immediately evident that they would like a czar in their country. So, for example, if you look at Estonia, Estonia has a population of around 25% or so that speaks Russian at home. But these Russian speakers who live in Estonia aren't demanding that Estonia find a czar for itself. Or similarly, when you look in Ukraine, where many people speak Russian and some may identify culturally as Russian, they're not demanding that Ukraine find a czar. So I'm resistant to the thesis that Russians themselves want czars or Israel. You think of 20% of the population of Israel is now from the former Soviet Union, Russian-speaking as well. They're not demanding an Israeli czar. So this thesis that Russians are infatuated with czars, I don't buy it. I think the question, which is the second part of your question that we ought to ask, is why haven't Russians complained about what they've got? And here I would put forth three explanations. And I think you need a bit from each explanation to understand how it is that Russians have come to tolerate Putin's government today. The first is that most Russians, with the exception of the youth, have lived through periods that are worse than today. So they lived through the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was immensely devastating. Then they lived through the 1990s, which is a period of hyperinflation, a period of unemployment, a period of wrenching political and social change. And so by comparison, when you've lived through that, the present day doesn't seem all that bad. So that's one explanation. It's been worse before. A second explanation is that nationalism remains an extraordinarily politically powerful force. And we might not like this to be true, but I think, unfortunately, it is true. And when you look at this surge in support for the Russian government after the annexation of Crimea, when Russians believed that their country was being made a great power again and it was being demonstrated on the world stage, that has proven an immensely durable well of support for the government, not only Putin personally, but for the government in general. So nationalism is explanation number two. And third, we shouldn't overlook the repression, that those Russians who do complain are often silenced and encouraged to either stay silent or move abroad. And so many of the Russians who would be the most vocal in demanding political change or in demanding that Russia no longer have government by czar, have government by democracy instead, have faced immense pressure in Russia and found it easier just to move to London or Berlin instead. So I think when you put all three of those reasons together, the docility of the Russian population today becomes more understandable.
We have three questions about young people. This is because we have a very young audience here today. Why are young people so persistently, Russian people, so persistently passive? Is the lack of political engagement by younger segments of the population due to apathy or fear? What sort of barriers exist for youth to participate in elections?
Well, the first thing to think about when you look at the apathy of the Russian youth is that Russian youth are not unique in being more apathetic than Russian middle-aged or elderly people. That's true in the U.S., that's true in most European countries. So youth apathy, lower rates of youth voting, that's a standard across many countries. But it certainly is the case that Russian youth are more apathetic. And so why might that be? Well, first is that if you're an 18-year-old Russian, you have never known a Russian president besides Vladimir Putin or for the 4 years when Putin was prime minister and Medvedev was president, but basically your entire life was in the Putin era, which was an era of politics when you were deliberately encouraged not to participate. You were encouraged to vote, but only for certain candidates. You were given a pretty small menu of candidates to vote for. And so there was never a period in which you were trained or encouraged to think critically about politics or to get involved. In fact, the opposite was true. So unlike in the United States, where most students take civics classes and they learn that political activity is a good thing on average, Russians have been encouraged to think the opposite, and that's been a deliberate strategy on behalf of the Russian government. And second, if you're a younger Russian, you haven't seen any good evidence that political participation can succeed in achieving its goals. So there haven't been good pieces of evidence of youth protests that have accomplished the change they wanted to accomplish. Unlike in other countries where we have protests that accomplish what they're looking to achieve, in Russia there's been none of that. So it's very difficult to mobilize people to go out in the street to face consequences, to not only personally but for their family as well in certain cases, in exchange for a goal that doesn't always seem that achievable. And so there too, I think when you put yourself in the perspective of Russian youth, who's been trained not to protest, not to complain, not to be politically active, and sees no evidence that political activity will in fact achieve what they want to achieve, suddenly I think the apathy becomes much easier to understand.
A couple of questions here about how the Russian government funds itself. How does Putin fund Russian expenditures? How essential is the role of state-owned organizations? And is it only oil, or are the other resources that Russia is rich in, gold, chrome, diamonds, cobalt, and lumber, also state-owned?
So when you look at Russian government revenue streams, as I mentioned, around half of it comes from the oil and gas sector, taxing oil and gas production. And that number varies a bit based on oil prices. So when oil prices are high, you get more revenue from oil and gas, and less when they're low. The other major sources of tax revenue are the types of taxes that we have in the U.S. or in many other countries, which are taxes on income and taxes on the rest of a value-added tax, so kind of like a sales tax.
The revenue from oil is not tax exactly, because it's a state-owned industry, isn't it?
Part of the oil industry is state-owned, but there's also part of it still in the private sector, in the hands of oligarchs who have learned that as long as they follow instructions, they can keep control of their assets. And so so oil that's produced by those firms is, for example, taxed. So the mechanism of bringing dollars from oil production or rubles from oil production to the government is a type of tax system with which we'd be relatively familiar.
Well, I guess the questioner here is asking that given that coming out of a collective state, the Russian government retained control of some industries, to what extent is the Russian government funded by its residual control of those industries?
It's actually the opposite. The Russian government wastes lots of money by owning enterprises, but it does so for political purposes. So it's not a good financial bet, quite the contrary. Okay. If these industries were run not by the government, they would almost certainly be run better than they are today, in part because they're not run to maximize profit. They're not run to be efficient. They're run to accomplish political goals. And so they accomplish these political goals relatively efficiently, but that's different than being profitable for the Russian government.
Okay. A couple of questions about the opposition. Could one factor of Putin's popularity be that there is no attractive alternative on the horizon, or is there? And aside from removing Putin, does the opposition have anything to suggest on its own account?
Well, the Russian opposition faces a catch-22, which is that under current circumstances, the Russian government really doesn't allow an attractive opposition to emerge, because that would be dangerous. So they allow a variety of relatively unattractive oppositions to exist, and they point to these oppositions and say, well, would you really want those guys governing? And that's been a pretty effective strategy, whereby most opposition movements look to the average Russian relatively unpopular, with maybe one exception, a fellow named Alexei Navalny, who came to become relatively prominent by pointing out corruption at state-owned firms and also by oligarchs close to Putin. Navalny has faced immense legal pressure. His brother's in jail on trumped-up charges. He's arrested and released on a pretty regular basis. But he seems to have found a message of pointing out the fact that the Russian elite is, in fact, extraordinarily corrupt, which does resonate with Russians. But he's not allowed to run. He wasn't allowed to run in the last presidential election. He probably won't be allowed to run in the next Moscow mayoral election, which he might want to run for. So he's very much marginalized, and that's because the Russian government realizes that he might be a threat. So they allow the ineffective opposition to persist, but the effective opposition are the ones that are marginalized and threatened by legal tools.
Is Russia a threat to Eastern European countries, and which ones in particular, and why?
Well, I think to answer that question, you need to think about the different types of countries in Central and Eastern Europe. So, for example, is Russia a threat to Ukraine? Well, yes, its troops are already in Ukraine. That's an obvious one. But is Russia a threat to Poland or to the Czech Republic? Well, that's a different type of threat. No one is really expecting Russian tanks to be rolling into Warsaw anytime soon. But it certainly is the case that, especially, for example, in the Czech Republic, there's a variety of worrisome ways in which Russian influence is felt. So, for example, via corrupt dealings in the energy sector in places like Hungary, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, Serbia, other countries in Eastern Europe, via a variety of business dealings that look, at least from the outside, to be relatively corrupt. So in Central and Eastern Europe, countries that are members of NATO, members of the EU, the Russian threat is less a military threat and more of a threat of kind of nefarious and dirty business dealings. That's the real thing we ought to be worried about. Whereas in countries in the former Soviet Union, Ukraine and Georgia above all, the threat is much more in a military sense. You see it in Ukraine today. And so, well, why is Russia, you might ask, wanting to use military force in Ukraine? It's because it believes that Ukraine is by right part of Russia's sphere of influence. Russians believe that Ukraine is not really an independent country. Yes, it has its own capital, its own government, but in reality, it's part of the Russian sphere. That's something that many Russians will tell you. But Russia's efforts to use political or diplomatic or economic tools to keep Russia, to keep Ukraine behaving along the lines that Russia set, failed. And so the only tool Russia has to turn to today is the military tool. And so it's used the military with some effect since 2014. It grabbed Crimea. That was worth something. It's fomenting this rebellion, funding these militias in eastern Ukraine. That's something as well. But it's also worth noting that although Russia's got these two chunks of Ukraine, it's lost the rest of Ukraine. Ukrainians, by all the polling data we have, are much less positively inclined towards Russians today than they were 4 years ago. Russian economic influence in Ukraine is significantly less today than it was 4 years ago. And Ukraine now has a functional military, which is able to impose very serious costs on the Russian. And that, as well, is a difference with 4 years ago. If you actually think back 4 years ago when the current crisis in Ukraine began, most of Ukraine's military was still prepared for an assault from the West, because that's where their military was stationed at the end of the Cold War. So think about that. When Crimea was being annexed, Ukrainian military installations were based primarily on the Western Front. Well, no longer.
Since you're talking about Ukraine, this questioner asks, how do we get our moral dudgeon up about Crimea when it's not so different from what we did in the Bay of Pigs?
Well, I think when we look back at the Bay of Pigs, we wouldn't say that was a very good thing to have done. In fact, the contrary.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible for Americans to say we've made mistakes in the past, and we might even be making mistakes in the present, but that doesn't condone other people making mistakes at the same time.
You cite a lot of economic statistics, but can we believe them? Can we believe, for instance, that there's an 80% approval rating of Putin, or are the numbers, do you believe them? Do you believe the numbers?
Broadly speaking, yes. With the economic data, we have multiple different ways to check the economic data. So, for example, if you think of trade data, it's not only, well, what does the Russian government say it's trading, but you can look at Russia's trading partners and ask, well, what are they trading with Russia? And if you get discrepancies in the numbers, then you can try to figure out what's causing them. But broadly speaking, the economic data is relatively good, with a couple of exceptions. The polling data is harder when you call Russians and ask them, well, do you support the president? But all of the political scientists that have looked into this in great detail, our experts on polling, our experts on public opinion, find that maybe there's a slight overestimation, but there's no question that 70% of Russians genuinely believe that they trust the president and think he's doing a decent job.
This question takes me a little by surprise for its premise, but it's interesting. In 2008, in the financial collapse of 2008, Russia bailed out Iceland. Is that true? And is that part of Putin's economic plan to invest in foreign governments, even with economic downfall?
Well, let me take the broader question of how Russia uses its financial power abroad. So there are a number of different ways it does that. So one is by investing in energy sector businesses, especially in Europe. So there are a number of European countries that are very reliant on Russia for gas imports. So, for example, in parts of the former Warsaw Pact, some countries import almost all of their gas from Russia. And so there's great concern in those countries that Russia could use that to turn off the gas and therefore put political pressure on these countries. So that's one way in which there's concern about Russian financial pressure abroad. But the bigger, actually, issue with Russian money abroad is not the Russian government spending billions of dollars buying off countries, but rather Russian business people and Russian oligarchs, especially those who live in London, but not only, using their money to buy influence in those countries. So, for example, there's a lot of concern, as there should be, about how Russian oligarchs fund universities in certain cases or research institutes, how they support political parties in certain instances. If you go to London, for example, it's impossible to not run into Russians everywhere you turn, and that's great for all the Russians who are there to study or to work legitimately, but there's also a small section of Russians who are there spending money that they didn't earn very legitimately and spending it to acquire influence on the British political process, for example. That's not very positive. And I think we see a lot of that in London, but we see a little bit of that in the U.S. too, and I think we ought to be wary of that.
I'm surprised that... could you comment briefly on the Russian Orthodox Church as a supporter of Putin?
Well, when you think of the Russian Orthodox Church today, the people who are running the church are people who came up through the church during the late Soviet period. And the church in Russia, or in the Soviet Union, during the Soviet period was very heavily integrated with the Russian security services, the KGB. And so as a result, within the Russian Orthodox Church, there are very vigorous debates about to what extent they need new personnel who aren't tainted by the fact that they were appointed during the communist period. But when you have that context in mind, it's not difficult to understand some of the links that have been drawn between the Kremlin today and the church leadership, because they came up through the church at a time when people like President Putin were at the KGB. And so there's a variety of personal links that have been very influential in shaping the Russian Orthodox Church political policies. And that's been important in legitimizing Putin's rule, not only at home, but also Russia's foreign policy in other parts of the Orthodox world.
Last question. Surprisingly, the only one on this subject. I thought there would be more. What insights do you have into the Putin-Trump relationship?
Well, probably not much more insight than you have into the Putin-Trump relationship. But let me actually zoom out and talk a bit about the U.S.-Russia relationship. And I'll relate this via an anecdote that I told several people last night. The day after the U.S. presidential election in 2016, I landed in Vladivostok for a series of meetings with a number of Russian experts on foreign policy. So I asked them, what do you think of the U.S. presidential election? All of them were hoping that Trump would win. And about half of the people I spoke to said, this is great news for Russia. Finally, we'll have a president who is not Russophobic. That was one view. But the second view, and about half of the Russians I spoke to had this view, is that, you know, Trump might want better relations with Russia, but the rest of the U.S. political establishment is much more skeptical. Congress, the media, the bureaucracy. And we realized that in the United States, policy is made not only by the president himself, but also by all of these different institutions interacting with each other. And so although it might be the case that Trump wants better relations with Russia, in fact, we predict that things won't get that much better because there will be gridlock over Russia policy, and all of the groups that remained skeptical of Russia will be that way in the future. And when you step back now, 18 months after my conversations with those Russians, it's the latter group that has been proven right. Whatever the president has wanted to do, and you know we can debate that, it's clear that he hasn't been able to do many of the things that he wanted to do, in part because the Congress and the media and the bureaucracy have had different ideas about what ought to be done. So it seems when you look at U.S.-Russia relations, you know, obviously there's great entertainment value and great intrigue in looking at the president himself, and for political purposes that's absolutely important. But as analyzing U.S.-Russian relations, in some ways it's useful to step back and look at the broader picture in U.S. institutions, and there's been less change than I think many of my Russian colleagues were at first hoping for.
Thank you, Chris Miller.
Thank you very much.